Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, March 20th, 2008. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. Well, this week, John Palmer, author of How to Brew and co-author of Brewing Classic Styles, joins us to answer the question, what is an IBU? Really? Well, it turns out we've been working under some false assumptions in the homebrew community. Well, if you're new to homebrewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. It's good to be back home and getting into the swing of things again, even though it's raining like crazy here and water's piling up everywhere. I went down to Austin last week to attend the South by Southwest Interactive Media Conference last week. And while I was down there, I had a chance to spend some time with Chris Colby, editor of Brew Your Own, and his wife, Jennifer, along with Alex and Ron from down around there. Chris brought some homebrew to the Ginger Man, five wonderful beers, and we sipped on them out back at the Ginger Man. And I have to tell you that Chris is an excellent brewer. If there was any doubt, that doubt is all gone, at least in my mind. And also Ron, also he brought a stout that was very nice too. So it was good to have a good conversation and good beers as well. And we were I was going to record an episode while we were down there sipping and talking, but the jukebox kicked in and I decided to take the night off. Something about good homebrew that, you know, just takes all the initiative right out of you. I also had fun down in Hot Springs, Arkansas, this past weekend at the world's shortest St. Patrick's Day parade. There's a little street, Bridge Street, in Hot Springs. It's only 98 feet long, so I guess any parade going down Bridge Street in Hot Springs is going to be the world's shortest whatever parade, probably. And I celebrated St. Patrick's Day and my cousin Tim's birthday by eating bratwurst and drinking German beers in a German restaurant nearby. Not exactly appropriate for the holiday, but, you know, we were wearing green while we were drinking the German beers and eating the German food. It's been a while since we looked into the mailbag, and I appreciate your patience in my delays in getting back to you recently as I travel about the country. Hopefully I can get back on my fairly lazy schedule as opposed to my really lazy schedule of getting back to you while I was traveling. Lars in Boston watched our recent video podcast episode on using starters to rescue old yeast, and he had this to say. Lars says, I noticed that you poured from the starter without cleaning or flaming the mouth of the bottle. In my paranoia, I always wipe with an iota-4-soaked cloth, inflame the mouth before pouring in case bacteria has found a home there on sugar left over from when the starter was made or wild yeast that just happened to land there while the starter fermented. Well, you're right, Lars. I figured somebody was going to call us on that. To be perfectly safe, you'll want to do what Lars suggests and wipe down the mouth of your starter or flame the top with a lighter before you pour your starter. However, I do have to say that I racked the Belgian wit that I brewed with that starter over to the secondary last night, and it tasted great. It was just really wonderful. So I guess the stars were aligned properly for Steve and me as we were tasting the starter in the kitchen that day. Ken in San Jose, California, writes about the same video podcast episode. Ken says, you and Steve always try your beers on the video podcasts, even the yeast starter, and say how good they are. Was the unhopped starter really that good? I can't imagine it was very tasty. Ken says, it's okay to say, yuck, this is awful. Well, I had a couple of questions about what a starter is supposed to taste like. Our starter with the Belgian wit yeast did, in fact, taste good, Ken. We wouldn't lie to you. It was sweet tasting because it didn't have any hops in it, but it was citrusy and had a bit of that Belgian wit character from the yeast in there, and it was very nice. So So there you go. When you think about tasting starters, instead of thinking what they should taste like, you might want to think about what they shouldn't taste like. If it tastes soured or spoiled or nasty in any way, then you need to get rid of it and not pitch that into your beer. That could be a sign of infection. And that's a really good way to test your yeast is to make a starter with it. And if it tastes great, then go ahead and brew with it. And if it tastes nasty, don't. You can save yourself a bunch of time, money, and effort by not pitching bad yeast into good wort. Matthew from Brampton, Ontario, Canada writes, I've never read anything that said what to do with my opened, half-used hop packets. I used to throw them away, thinking they were not going to last until my next brew day. With the hop shortage, I'm questioning that. Can an opened, half-used hop packet be saved? Well, Matthew, you should take those unused hops and pack them up very carefully and send them to me, and I'll dispose of them in the appropriate manner. No, seriously, you should... You should put them in the freezer. Just seal them up in a Ziploc bag or something and put them in the freezer and use them next time you brew. As you'll hear in this show, the character of your hops will change over time, but they'll still be good for brewing. So, no, don't throw your hops away, especially nowadays with all the hop shortage and everything. Don't throw your hops away. Put them in the freezer, seal them up tight, and they should be perfectly good to use. And it might give you more incentive to brew more often if you've got hops waiting for you in the freezer. Jason from Wisconsin writes, 6 weeks ago I started homebrewing, and I love it. I've made 4 5-gallon batches so far. The first two were John Bull extract kits, and the others I stepped right into all grain. The question I have is, all of my beer has a cidery or sweet taste that's disappearing with time. In the extract kits, I did not use sugar as instructions stated. I used light malt extract. Smart move. Good job, Jason. He says, is this because the beer is young yet? There is no infection in the bottles. Every week the first batch is getting better, but it's hard to have patience and wait. Well, I think you answered your own question there, Jason. You know, you're getting into the hobby and you're going great guns, and, you know, in 6 weeks... You've brewed 4 or 5 gallon batches, and, you know, your beers are not tasting perfect yet. Well, they're green. I think that, you know, you need to just slow down on the drinking part. You know, keep going on the brewing part, but slow down and give your beer some more time to age. Your brews are being bottle conditioned by the yeast in the bottle, and that's essentially another fermentation process that's happening in there. And the yeast needs time to condition your beer. I mean, you're making real ale. You're not making those commercial beers that have the fresh drink by date on them. You're making real ale, and that real ale needs time to condition. So take your time in drinking those beers. Having patience is one of the hardest part of home brewing, I know, but if you keep brewing at the rate you're going, you'll have plenty of beer in the pipeline that you can drink if you just wait a couple more weeks per batch to start cracking them open. So in your case, Jason, relax, don't worry, drink a good commercial beer until yours are ready to drink. Okay, it's time to put your advanced brewer hat on. John Palmer recently went to a conference that changed the way he thinks about IBUs, or International Bitterness Units, what they are and where they come from. He wrote about what he found in Brew Your Own magazine, and he joins us this week to clue us in. Well, John Palmer, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thank you very much, James. It's great to be here.
Well, before we launch into our discussion of IBUs, I want to talk to you about your trip coming up in October. I noticed that I got an email from the organizers of the Australian National Homebrewing Conference, which is coming up in October, that you and Jamil Zainashev are going down there to, I guess, be the keynote speakers.
Yeah, isn't that a hoot? I'm really looking forward to it. This will be a lot of fun. I've never had the chance to travel abroad before, really. So heading to the other side of the earth.
Yeah, that's got to be exciting. Do you know what you're going to talk about yet?
Well, we've been talking with the organizers, and they would like to hear about American Pale Ale, kind of its origin, and I guess it. At first glance, it seemed like an odd subject to us, then again, it's to an Australian, American Pale Ale is probably kind of interesting, just like a British Pale Ale is interesting to us here in the U.S. So, we're going to talk a little about the history of the style, how the style evolved, talk about the hops that characterize it, a variety of things. I think Jamil's going to talk about the book and talk about his recipes and his techniques and I'll probably touch on other technical topics like water and foam and, who knows whatever they want to hear.
What are you looking to learn when you're down there?
I'm just really excited to get the chance to taste some Australian homebrews. I judge every year at our national homebrew competition, and I know we brew beers that are often better than what you can buy, in terms of complexity and freshness and so on. And I'm eager to try theirs too, to try their interpretations of styles, see how they compare.
You'll have to dispel your feeling of Australian beer being characterized by big Foster's oil cans.
That's right.
Well, for those who are interested, I am going to put a link to the conference in the description of this episode on basicbrewingradio.com. And I'm talking to the organizers about some more stuff later on down the line coming from that. So that's exciting.
Indeed.
Let's talk about IBUs. Now, according to a book I recently read by a well-known author, an IBU is defined as 1 milligram of isomerized alpha acid per 1 liter of beer. Would you know anything about that?
Yeah, I believe I said something very similar to that, if not exactly the same in my book.
It was your book. So now you're saying that that's not right?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's wrong. I attended a really unique conference this past summer in August 2007. It was the International Brewer Symposium on Hop Flavor and Aroma up there at Oregon State University. And it was really the first really big international conference on hop flavors and how hop character comes into the beer. And we had just renowned hop scientists from all over the world, Belgium, the UK, Japan. I think there was a gentleman from South Africa there, and of course, lots of scientists from Budweiser and Coors here in the U.S. and all the big micros too. So just a real complete cross section of brewers today, all talking about hop flavor and aroma.
Wow!
And one paper, the one paper that I really had a chance of understanding there was talking about IBUs, and so I've based my article in this most recent issue of BYO on this talk by Val Peacock of Budweiser. He talked about the history of the IBU and what it's derived from and what it means. So. It really opened my eyes to what we have so glibly been saying is just 1 milligram per liter of isomerized alpha acid.
Now, first of all, I want to say that I'm shocked that there was a material there that you couldn't understand. And second of all, it means that I would be completely lost if I were there. So,
well, you know, you certainly wouldn't have been alone in that room. I mean, it was really just a fascinating experience. We're in, you know, college lecture hall, and these scientists were standing up, and some of them were even, you know, showing us those little molecular toothpick models that they have, and, you know, spinning things around, saying, okay, now we've got this group here, whatever it was, you know, and you can see this versus this. I'm going, yeah. A lot of organic chemistry. It was really quite fascinating. And, you know, you sat back and absorbed as much as you could. And I'm really looking forward to the proceedings of the conference to be published soon, so I can get a chance to go back and read some of this.
Now let's go back in time to kind of understand, you know, where we are today. How did scientists first go about perceiving how hop bitterness worked in beer?
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, they had known throughout the early 1900s that, you know, they've always known that the bitterness came from the hops. But it wasn't until the early 1900s that they realized that what they measured and could isolate from a hop cone was not actually present in beer. That is, you know, the lupulin that they would isolate from hops, they couldn't find any lupulin or anything of that structure in beer itself. So they started determining that some change is occurring, you know, during the brewing process. And during the 20s, 30s, and 40s, they, you know, used new techniques to isolate these compounds and determine their molecular structures. And about 1940, they started describing the bittering potential of the oxidized beta acids as well as the isomerized alpha acids. And once they had found these things, then they said, well, if these items are what makes beer bitter, we should learn how to measure that and quantify it so we can predict it. And so that's what they set out doing. And I guess a lot of that work was done in the 50s with a technique called countercurrent distribution. It's a forerunner of today's high-performance liquid chromatography. But they used chemistry methods and solvent extraction to gradually isolate isomerized alpha acid and other chemically similar compounds and concentrate those. And then they tried measuring that. And one method that they used to measure those was the spectrophotometric methods, similar to what they do for beer color, where they shine light of a certain wavelength through a sample and measure how much light is absorbed by the sample.
And so then they started discovering that there was not only one compound, but you have your humulone and your cohumulone and you know, all the things that we hear and read about.
Right. They discovered that there's three forms of alpha acids and three forms of beta acids. You had your normal humulone, you had the cohumulone, and you had the adhumulone forms. And likewise with your beta acids, you had the lupulone, co-lupulone, and ad-lupulone compounds. So all of these are isomers of each other, and they all contribute to bitterness. Although the beta acids aren't bitter. It's only their oxidation products that are soluble and bitter and end up in the beer.
So where did the formula of an IBU is defined as 1 milligram of isomerized alpha acids per 1 liter of beer, where did that come into the equation? In the early days, or where does that come in?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not really sure. I think they in the early days when they were able to really isolate each compound, they probably, tasted, the isoalpha and said, oh, this is really bitter. This is probably the main one. And they kind of focused on isoalpha. Then I think because – and I think part of the fault is ours, as homebrewers, where – we've gotten used to looking for the amount of alpha acids in a hop when we buy them at the store, and calculating IBUs based on alpha, and I think it was just a natural to assume that the IBU is only based on isoalpha acid, and we didn't realize that there was more to it than that. A team of scientists by the names of Rigby and Bethune, they had come up with a method of solvent extraction for isoalpha. But it took a long time. It took like a whole day to isolate the isoalpha from a sample of beer and then measure it. It involved a couple of different solvents and a lot of steps to really purify it. And even then, they discovered that their attempt to measure that and correlate that to just isoalpha in the beer, they were often off by 30%. They would be 30% high. So another team that they were had kind of talked with and communicated with their names are Moltke, something like that, and Mielgard. They took a step back and they said, well, let's try a simpler solvent extraction. And instead of focusing on just isoalpha, let's isolate everything that's chemically similar to isoalpha that probably also contributes to perceived bitterness. And let's measure that. And so that's what they did. And it was a faster, a little simpler method. And by 1968, that method was the one that the ASBC and the European Brewing Congress standardized on. And they realized that they weren't measuring isoalpha; they were measuring bitter stuff. And so what they said was, let's take a sample of a bunch of beers that are currently brewed. And let's take our data and we'll say that this, we taste this beer and it's more bitter than this one, and it measures X and this one measures Y. And so they, graphed all their data, drew a line through it, and said, well, that that line is about a slope of 51.2593, whatever, and let's round that off to 50. It's close enough. It still kind of goes through the data there. That'll be our IBU. That'll be our IBU equation. So with
all the tests and all the chemists standing around in their labs, the human bitterness perception, the tongue, had a factor in determining this formula.
That's right. Where 20 IBUs was placed and 30 IBUs was placed was really an arbitrary line based on beers being brewed at the time.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how does that translate to today? Are those kinds of measurements, is that still applicable today?
Well, yeah, it is, because the ASBC method, the spectrophotometric method of shining a light of a specific wavelength through a sample, it's an easy test, and it's a repeatable test. It can be carried out in minutes, and you don't need a lot of equipment to do it. So, all breweries can afford the equipment to do this measurement. And so when you get on a brewery's website and you read that you know, Lost Coast amber ale is, you know, 40 IBUs. Well, that's been measured by this method. HPLC, which as homebrewers tend to think of for measuring IBUs, is really not. It's used for measuring the amount of alpha in hops, and it's used for measuring the amount of isomerized alpha acid in beer. But that test takes about an hour per sample. There are, you know, I was talking to Brad Sturgeon a couple months ago, and he said there are new HPL machines coming out that are more advanced and can do a test in, you know, minutes instead of an hour. But those aren't generally available.
It's kind of like the Fahrenheit scale in that when it was created, the numbers were sort of arbitrary. But since that standard was set, you can still, once you know what those numbers correlate to, it's still a useful scale. I mean, Celsius is more useful. Mm-hmm. But with Fahrenheit, if you say to someone who's used to dealing with Fahrenheit that the water is 32 degrees, then that means something. So if we say that a beer is 40 IBUs, that means something even though the scale is kind of arbitrary.
That's true. And I think what it means to us today, or what we have to understand about today, is that a 20 IBU beer then is much different than a 20 IBU beer today. Where because the hop varieties have changed, the proportion of alpha and beta acids that go into the beer that make up that IBU then versus now have changed. 40 years ago when this standard was being put in place, you know, the hops were typically a year old when they were brewed. You know, they had been shipped across the sea, they may have been refrigerated, but even, you know, 40 or 50 degrees refrigeration for a year will still result in half the alpha acids being oxidized and their potential being lost to the beer. But meanwhile, during that time, the beta acids are oxidizing, and their bittering potential is going to contribute to the beer. So, I mean, the whole hop character, you know, 40 years ago, you know, was very different than today's high alpha variety hops that are, you know, stored and picked and used fairly quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So 30 IBUs then and 30 IBUs now, different beers, different profile.
So you could brew with year old hops that weren't stored at optimum conditions, and you could brew with fresh hops with optimum conditions, have two beers with the same technical IBU number, but the character of the beer would be different.
Would be different. Yeah, that's right.
Would the perceived bitterness be different?
Yes. They've done several studies on this over the years. One that I was reading from 1987, done in Japan, they did an experiment very much like this, where they took year-old hops that had been stored, you know, in a refrigerated yet kind of open bag condition. They brewed with those, and then they brewed with fresh hops, beers that were designed to be similar to their standard lagers at a 22 IBUs. And the fresh hop beer, interestingly enough, had 23.5 parts per million of isomerized alpha acid as measured by HPLC versus the 22 IBU spectrophotometric measurement. So it actually had more alpha than the IBU number indicated.
Huh.
Whereas the aged hop beer only had about 3.5 parts per million of isoalpha acid.
Wow.
But measured 22 IBUs on that spectrophotometric method. There we go. Wow. So, you know, big difference in the, in what constituted that IBU number. And they had a tasting panel taste the beers. The aged hop beer had a less sharp bitterness, a less assertive bitterness. Did not have much hop aroma to it, but you know, was perceived as being a softer bitterness.
Hmm.
But interestingly enough, all five panelists preferred the fresh hop beer flavor and aroma.
Ah.
And it's not because the aged hop beer had an oxidized bitterness. You know, it wasn't a rough or harsh or tannic bitterness. It was just different. And I recently kind of repeated this experiment myself unintentionally. I my beer fridge died last summer.
Oh, no.
And I didn't realize it for months because I was busy on other things. But basically, all my hops in the freezer warmed up to, you know, room temperature all summer long. And they were in oxygen barrier bags. And I brewed with some Hallertau. When was that? I guess it was around the holidays. Brewed some Hallertau that still smelled nice. I used 4 ounces in a 1050 beer. And I think I probably got about 25 IBUs out of it.
Hmm.
And, but as, you know, as hoppy as that beer smelled while it was brewing, there is no hop aroma in that beer to drink it now.
Huh.
You know, people were just amazed at all the hops I was dumping in. It's like, wow, that smells great. Look at all that hops. When that beer, you know, now to drink that beer, no hop aroma, definitely a hop bitterness, but it had started out being an American wheat beer, you know, kind of noble hopped American wheat mm-hmm. kind of beer. But really, it's more of a I'd call it like a, more of like a southern brown ale now.
Huh.
I had added some pale chocolate and stuff to it to darken it up a bit. But it's really got a subdued hop presence, assertive bitterness, but no hop flavor or aroma to speak of.
So how does this affect our calculations when we're formulating homebrew recipes? How does this information carry over into something that we can use when we're coming up with new beers?
Well, that's a really broad question, actually.
That's my job.
there's several factors. I think one, you know, just on age of the hops. If we were to get, you know, more technical with our IBU calculator, you know, calculations, if we wanted to differentiate between oxidized beta and alpha acid bitterness, we would need to take the age of the hops into consideration and the storage temperature and have to have a model that we could go to predict, you know, what the ratio of oxidized beta to alpha is. We'd need to know the ratio of alpha acids to beta acids in the hops to figure out, you know, what the contributions would be. The, you know, older hop varieties, all your noble hops, your older hop varieties like Cluster and Cascade and, you know, some of the older varieties have been around for a while. They all typically have 4 to 6% beta acids in them. And, you know, when you look at the alpha potentials of those hops, and a lot of like East Kent Goldings also, typically it's a 1-to-1 kind of ratio between alpha acids to beta acids. But in today's high alpha varieties, Columbus, Sterling, a lot of the hybrids and so on that are available today. Typically, you have a 2-to-1 or 3-to-1 ratio of alpha to beta.
Hmm.
So, And they have better storability. So even though you may lose, you know, if the hops are a little old, you may have lost, you know, I don't know, 20%, 30% of your alpha. You still have a predominantly alpha acid-based hop and with only a small contribution from oxidized beta acids. So, yeah, it's kind of a wrinkle trying to figure out that aspect of what you're putting into the beer.
So some varieties, if they have an even alpha and beta acid makeup, if they get older, they'll still be as bitter, but the character of that bitterness will change. But the higher
That's
alpha
right.
acid percentage hops, when they get older, they'll actually become less bitter.
Yes. You'll see a greater drop in perceived bitterness from on a weight basis, you know, one ouncer, you know, 20, 50 grams of say, Columbus hop versus, you know, 20 grams of East Kent Goldings or Fuggle mm-hmm. is another example. You know, those of a older hop variety would kind of lose and gain bitterness on an even ratio, whereas the high alpha variety would just lose alpha and not gain so much bitterness as a function of hop weight due to age.
Now, another thing that you mentioned in your article, we have been trained through reading literature of all kinds that hop alpha acid isomerization is affected by wort gravity.
But yeah, we have, haven't we? Like I said, this seminar, this whole conference was a real eye opener for me. Made me realize that I had been, you know, following the same assumptions as everyone else for a long time. But yeah, it turns out that isomerization kinetics, that is the rate at which alpha acid will isomerize into isoalpha and become soluble, that's pretty constant. The amount of wort gravity really doesn't affect that. Hardly at all. But what the effect of wort gravity is actually in how much hot break material that wort generates. And alpha acid likes to, or doesn't like to, but it will, you know, cling to break material. It'll cling to the sides of the boil kettle. It'll cling to the sides of the fermenter. And all of that alpha and isoalpha that clings to surfaces and clings to break material and to yeast as it you know, falls out of solution, all that carries isomerized alpha acid out of solution and affects the IBU measurement. So the function of wort gravity on IBUs that we use in our hop calculations, in our IBU calculations, it's not the effect of decreased solubilization. It's the effect of increased break material and isoalpha loss as a function of gravity.
It helps me to think about alpha acid as particles of stuff. And if those particles of stuff get stuck to other things or get stuck to the side, then they're not going to be in your beer when you put it in the fermenter, essentially.
That's right. And, in that same – along that same point, if you think about a Belgian triple, you know, where you have 20% of refined sugar making up your boil gravity, that's going to have 20% less break material than an all malt beer, and less isoalpha is going to be carried out of solution.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, if you're doing a rye pale ale or a wheat beer, where you've got a percentage of, you know, wheat malt or wheat or rye adjunct in there that has more protein in it, That's going to contribute to more hot break material, and it's going to be more isoalpha carried out of solution. So your utilization, your hop utilization is going to decrease in that case.
Now, let me ask you an off-the-wall question. In as I understand it, in talking to Bob Hansen from Breese Malt and Ingredients, a lot of the protein, the hot break, is coagulated out of the wort at the extract manufacturer. So when you get extract, when you do an extract beer, you don't have as much break material, correct?
That's right. That's right.
So we've been telling people if you, you know, when you're doing a split boil and you're shooting for a final or an original gravity of 1050 for your beer, and you only boil half of the volume of water with your extract, you're actually boiling a wort of 1100.
That's right.
And we've been telling people that because the density of wort affects the isomerization of hops, that, you know, it's best to add most of the extract near the end of the boil so you won't affect the hop utilization.
Mm-hmm.
So how does this news affect that advice?
I think the spirit of the advice is still sound.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe the magnitude of the advice is reduced. Because going to the fact that extract has already been boiled once and a lot of the hot break material has come out. Now, hot break precipitation, you know, or coagulation precipitation in the boil is a function of the total amount of protein present and the temperature you reach during the boil, which it really doesn't change very much. It's like shifts a half a degree or something, because we're not talking really high gravities when we brew, even when you do a concentrated boil with like 10-100.
Mm-hmm.
The boiling point doesn't elevate appreciably. It may be able to go up to 100.5 Celsius or 101, but, I mean, it's small. So there's a solubility limit of protein at boiling point. And so you've got a supersaturated solution, hot break comes out. When you take that extract and now you do a normal gravity boil, let's say a 1040 wort boil, well, most of that protein has already come out. You're not going to get very much hot break in a 1040 wort malt extract boil, because most of the hot breaks already happened.
Mm-hmm.
So you're probably going to get less alpha taken out of solution then. If you do a concentrated boil, then, you know, this 10-100 that we talk about, where you put all the extract in the pot and boil it for the whole hour, you know, you get a lot of hot break then, because you've gotten, you know, a lot higher concentration of protein that's going to precipitate out.
Mm.
And that is going to carry off a percentage of the isoalpha. But the unknown here is the amount of hot break from a concentrated malt extract boil of 10-100, is that the same amount of hot break you would get from a all-grain mash of 10-100, mm-hmm. you know, a boil of 10-100? Probably not. Probably it's, you know, it's malt extract. It's already been boiled once. There's probably less total protein at that gravity, you know, that perceived gravity of 10-100 than there would be, you know, for the real thing.
Yeah, I can tell you from my experience with small batches, you know, and doing just like a 3-quart batch of beer, doing an all grain and doing an extract of the same recipe, essentially the same gravity of wort, it's a big difference.
there's a whole lot
more break to deal with, you know, after you've chilled the wort with an all grain batch. In fact, you know, I have to modify my recipes because there's just too much stuff in the bottom of the brew pot. So,
well, have you been able to perceive a difference in bitterness between the beers?
I haven't brewed them side by side, But
to check that. Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't. I don't think it's. I don't know. Tell you the truth, but I guess to add to the point about adding most of the extract late to the boil, there are other advantages, like you get more wort darkening if you boil all of your extract the full 60 minutes. So, you know, it's still good advice to add most of it at the late part of the boil anyway.
Yes, I think so. I think you end up with a fresher beer flavor with the extract late method than you do with a concentrated boil method. I think you get a much truer to style flavor profile from the beer with extract late versus concentrated boil. And that goes, you know, it goes with the darkening. It's the Maillard reactions that occur, and you get different reactions at different gravities. So you're going to end up with different flavor profiles at different gravities. And because, you know, we as consumers are used to tasting commercial beers, you know, of an example of a style that have been brewed in a traditional way, you know, a 1040 boiling to a, you know, 1045 kind of thing, versus a high gravity brew where it's boiled at, you know, 1090 and then diluted down to 1040 in package. We're used to a set of flavor profiles out of that boil that that's not a high gravity boil flavor. Let's hearken the listeners back to your hop IBU study of last summer. I listened to that show with a lot of interest and contacted Brad Sturgeon and the other gentleman, Paul, I believe his name was.
Or is it? Paul Charlesworth.
Yes. And,
Sorry,
and as well as Mark Smith, and got some, you know, a little more background data because I was curious on, you know, the discrepancy of, you know, what we had calculated with the formulas, you know, Mosher, Tinseth, Daniels, and so on, Rager, versus what was actually measured in the beers. And I think, by and large, usually a couple of the formulas at least were within 5, which is 5 IBUs is considered to be kind of like the resolution of the human palate.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, okay, that's not bad. But there is one beer that was quite a bit off, and I think the calculation was for like 18 or 20 or something like that IBUs, and it was around 20 for the Hefeweizen, and yet it only measured 7 in the photometric test. And but I think the fact that that was brewed with, you know, an actual German Hefeweizen yeast makes the difference. You had more yeast mass in the beer for a longer period of time, and was able, you know, to take out isomerized alpha acid and other, you know, bittering compounds. And I think that probably greatly affected this, you know, this solvent extracted photometric method.
So that's another variable to put into the equation, the type of yeast that you use as well as the other stuff.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. You, in that one, you had, like, you know, the extra wheat, you know, the higher wheat and the higher protein content or break, as well as more yeast mass that, you know, was going to potentially absorb more hops. I mean, this is all speculation on my part, but.
Right. But fairly educated guessing.
I suppose.
So what's the bottom line, John? I mean, what do we. What should we as homebrewers keep in mind from now on from listening to this conversation?
Well, I think it's like swimming in the ocean. There are lots of sharks, and chances are you're never going to run into one. I think this information is, you know, academically it's interesting. It's something to keep in mind, perhaps, if you are searching for that factor that, you know, threw your last, you know, beer off in terms of what you had expected it to taste like. And I think certainly the age of the hops is something to realize, you know, that's going to affect your perceived bitterness, you know, and it's not taken into account in the IBU calculations. I think understanding that the gravity factor that we use for utilization in the hop, you know, hop IBU calculations, understanding that is not, you know, the solubility of the alpha, it's the amount of break material and stuff that gets carried out of solution that's mm-hmm. the real difference. But, you know, we've been using our IBU calculations now for 30 years. We've generally brew in style with them, you know, in terms of BJCP judging and competitions. So I think it's one of those things where you just say, relax, don't worry, you have a homebrew.
Very good.
To borrow from a wise man.
There you go. Well, on that note, I appreciate your time once again, and I look forward to the next time.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot, James.
Well, thanks again to John Palmer. Just goes to show you, if you keep your eyes, ears, and mind open, you can always learn new things. John is the author of How to Brew and the co-author with Jamil Zainasheff of Brewing Classic Styles. You can read John's article in Brew Your Own magazine. And by the way, if you click on the banner for BYO and BasicBrewingRadio.com, you can get a free copy. And if you subscribe after receiving your free issue, you'll be helping to support this podcast. And I'll also, if I remember, put a link to the Australian Homebrewing Conference that's coming up in October. I'll put that in the description of this episode on BasicBrewingRadio.com. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com. Or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Somebody the other day assumed that this last part was always pre-recorded. It's not. Do it fresh every week, just for you. Check out our low-tech lagering and decoction mashing DVD on basicbrewingshop.com, where you can see Steve do a single-step decoction mash, Steve Wilkes. And follow me through a lager fermentation in the middle of summertime here in Northwest Arkansas, where I don't use a dedicated chest freezer. There are also our original DVDs, Basic Brewing Introduction to Extract Home Brewing, where we walk you through the extract brewing process step by step from boiling to bottling. And in Basic Brewing Stepping into All Grain, we take you through the all grain process from milling your grain to collecting your wort. We talk about batch sparging and fly sparging and infusion mashing and step mashing, all in a cool, interactive, non-linear format. We got combo deals on the site to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time. And you can also see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. Support your local homebrew shop. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order it online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Also got the hats and shirts. And thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link as well. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Transdisciplinary Play-Based Intervention, Guidelines for Developing a Meaningful Curriculum for Young Children. And Halex BristleTech 3000 Steel Tip Dart Set. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We appreciate your support there. Well, that's it. It's all until next week. Till then, thanks for listening. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson, our buddy in Austin. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.